Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Transnational criminal organizations are looming ever larger in the context of global affairs as well as for present-day consumers. For consumers, we worry about stolen credit card information or identity theft. While this is a concern for government, a far greater concern is how these criminal enterprises are influencing global affairs and world hotspots through supplying arms, cash, and supplies for terrorist and extremist groups, corrupting foreign governments and entities, and destabilizing economic markets. While the internet and digital communications play a role in the growing success of these criminal networks, my guest today says it's old-fashioned smuggling and illicit trafficking that provides the bulk of funding, and it's everything from guns, illegal drugs, human trafficking, and stolen technology, to counterfeit apparel, pirated music and film, pornography, or prescription drugs. Now, when we purchase something in those latter categories, that means many of us may play an unwitting role in these organizations' power and influence. That was the subject of my guest's talk to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Dr. Suzette Gerlot is the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. She also serves as vice provost for international programs and is the William J. Crowell Chair in Geopolitics. She is the author of numerous articles and several books on global governance and international security. She teaches in global community, global security, international activism, and illicit trafficking. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and she spoke with us while she was here. Dr. Gerlot, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me here.
You know, everything I've read recently in how a law enforcement, both domestic and internationally, are really struggling to keep up with the strides transnational criminal organizations, the advances they've been able to make in stealing basically anything they want, everything from money to drugs to arms and technology itself, due to all of this new digital technology. Can you give us a sense of where that competition is between those two forces?
Well, some refer to this as the dark side of globalization. Moises Naim, for example, in his book Illicit, refers to it as that. Others have said the same thing, that, you know, when you have an open economy that, you know, with kind of unfettered flows of goods and services and people and money, that the easier it is to trade in anything creates an environment where you can also trade in more nefarious products. And it makes it easier for organized criminals, organized criminal networks, individuals bent on causing harm, or at least making a profit and perhaps causing harm in the process, can engage in that darker side of the trade, smuggling, trafficking in drugs, in weapons, in humans, but also in animals and art and antiquities and counterfeit products. I mean, so it's a very wide range of items. There's nothing that would stop somebody from being able to, you know, use the same trafficking routes for drugs as they would use for humans, as they would use for fake handbags. So the methods, the means, the modes are very similar. And so, you know, when you open up the world to trade, you open it up to all kinds of trade, and it creates a potentially dangerous situation that governments do struggle to keep up with.
And how effective are governments and multinational organizations doing at counteracting this illegal trade?
They're doing their best, and they're spending a lot of time on it. I've traveled around the world. I wrote a book on port security, for example, visiting ports around the world in many different countries. And there are definitely committed professionals, government officials, and others that are hoping to address this, that are working every day to address these problems, to prevent the illicit trafficking of all kinds of products and people. But they don't have, the advantages are not really in their favor, in the sense that governments are obviously slow to react. They're bureaucratic. They have borders. They have to respect sovereignty. So criminals and those that are engaged in the illicit side of things don't have to follow these rules, and in fact can easily find a way to hide and conceal themselves. And you know, there are lots of industries that have cropped up to just help somebody who wants to get through a border or get items through borders to do that, to be able to do that, whether it's counterfeit documents or obviously bribes and other types of corrupt activities. So the advantages in this open market economy are obviously going to fall on the criminal side. But governments are clearly committed. They are spending billions and billions of dollars and doing their best to address this. But it's definitely an asymmetrical problem.
When you talk about this problem, I think most people have the perception when they think about transnational crime and its ability to steal money and various items, we think of it being a digital situation where you're stealing credit card numbers, you're stealing trade secrets through hacking and that like. You're really talking about old-fashioned trade for the most part.
That's right. You're right, too. I mean, the sense that the internet and the digital world has allowed this business, if you will, this illicit trade, to grow exponentially. So deals are now done, obviously, on the internet. Money is easy to transfer and hide. Counterfeit products are traded and sold on the internet daily. So the internet is a source of expansion and a source of being able to move these products around. But yes, the good old-fashioned route of just putting things in a container or putting them on a ship, or you know, we still have a lot of people that are migrating by boat across the Mediterranean, for example, lots of illegal migrants, people that are walking across borders, things that are being trafficked, you know, through mountain borders. So, I mean, you still see the whole range. The old-fashioned is still there, and we can't discount that. But clearly, the internet has, the digital world has really contributed to the tremendous growth and the inability of governments to easily track that and find it and stop it, because it just gets moved and rerouted and it's, you know, kind of just easily playing a game of chess, really, in the digital world. So it's both. It's the whole spectrum. And that's really what is extremely challenging to governments and other organizations, governmental and non-governmental, that try to address these problems.
And I guess, as you alluded to earlier, the organizations that are involved in this sort of follow in three broad categories. Those that are simply doing it for profit, say your typical criminal organization. There's also a criminal organization that is, again, doing it for profit, but there's probably some political agenda in which they're helping outlaw states or outlaw groups within states or actual terrorist organizations as a part, because it's lucrative and there may be some political commingling, if you will, of overall goals. And then there are terrorist organizations. Can you give us a sense of the number and scope of all of these?
Well, from my experience and what the data show, and let me just say by mentioning data, that data on these subjects are really difficult to come by, obviously. It's illicit for a reason and secretive for a reason, and therefore hard to track and hard to quantify and hard to study, for that matter, because it's not all above board. So there's a lot of best guesstimates that go into these things. And when we talk about illicit trade and illicit activities and these different categories of individuals and groups. But I can say from my own experience and from my own research that the overwhelming majority of people that engage in this kind of activity are those that are making a profit. You know, as they've said to me many times, my area of particular expertise is arms trafficking. And I've spent some time talking to, interviewing, watching how arms dealers work. And when I ask them this question, when I would ask, you know, are you committed to one side or the other side, or some, you know, do you have some sort of agenda here? It was most often than not, it was a no. It was, I'm a capitalist. I'm making money. I'm, you know, earning a living just like you and me. You're just, they saw themselves as business people. And this was a commodity to trade in weapons in this case. And I think you'll find that pretty clearly across the board. Now, yes, you do have those that have a particular agenda that are trying to support a side or another side or some sort of particular outcome. There's no doubt. And yes, you do have terrorists. And I would almost put them in that category of wanting to support a particular outcome. They have a particular agenda that they're trying to achieve. And what we do know about terrorists along these lines is that all terrorists are in some way, shape, or form traffickers. Now, not all traffickers. In fact, the overwhelming majority of traffickers are not terrorists, but all terrorists are traffickers. That is how they make their money. That is how they gain access to their weapons and to their resources. So when we engage in any kind of activity that contributes to the illicit underworld, if you will, it can and it often does end up contributing to terrorist activity, because all terrorists are traffickers.
Now, those traffickers that are terrorists, are they dealing with arms exclusively, or is it a wide range of drugs? Give us a sense. Are they trafficking in all sorts of illegal products or laundering money and things like
that? They're doing all the above, because, again, this is they're not necessarily, you know, they may have legitimate ways of making money, of engaging in businesses where they generate revenue, or that they can legally procure, or at least, you know, more legally procure the items that they need to engage in their activities, their terrorist activities. But most often than not, they can't. They don't, you know, operate above board. So they're engaging in a range of trafficking activities, particularly lucrative ones. Obviously, they need weapons. They need items that will cause destruction and terror. And so there's that access. So trading in and gaining access to illicitly trafficked weapons is one thing that they certainly do. But they also need money. They've got to have money to support their operations, to provide for housing or property, food, you know, support to their entire network. So, you know, they engage in other lucrative forms of trafficking
activities. Does that include illegal drug trafficking?
Absolutely. Of course, illegal drug trafficking is the most lucrative form of trafficking by far. More so than anything else. And that's illegal drugs that are creating the largest amount of revenue. But there is a growing, and I would say at some point in time, perhaps may even equalize with illegal drugs, the production of and illicit trade in prescription drugs. That is a huge and growing market, as is human trafficking, by the way. There's a lot of human trafficking that's quite lucrative, primarily because, you know, when you traffic some drugs, drugs are consumed. And so you engage in it in some sort of
one-on-one transaction.
And it's gone, right? But where humans, particularly when trafficked into certain industries, are lucrative in the sense that they can produce revenue over and over and over again.
And I think people, when they think of human trafficking, they're thinking of some sort of sexual trafficking of women. But it could also be for cheap labor. It could be impressing crews to go work somewhere as well. Is that true?
That's right. The human trafficking world is actually quite large again, and there's this broad spectrum of people that are voluntarily entering the illicit trafficking of humans that say, I need to get out of wherever it is I am, and so I'm going to pay a smuggler, or I'm going to somehow engage in illegal and illicit migration.
And once I arrive at my destination, I'm going to pay that guy for so many years as a
right,
part of that.
That's right.
And so, that's where you get that extra value.
Exactly, because the documents are taken. They owe – it's like indentured servitude, and many people refer to today's human trafficking as modern-day slavery because they find themselves in an environment where they are stuck in a new land. They don't have documents. They're there illegally, and they have to work off those debts, and they're usually working off those debts in industries that may be illicit as well, whether it's selling counterfeit products or engaging in the sex industry. But you do have a rather large segment of the human trafficking population that has somehow entered that pipeline, if you will, voluntarily or in some way, shape, or form thought, you know, have been deceived. They thought they were going to be, you know, working in, let's say, a domestic industry, cleaning houses or cutting the grass or what have you. And the next thing they know, they're, you know, more or less slaves, indentured servants. And then, of course, you have a very disturbing and growing number of individuals that are sold into the sex industry or, you know, into brothels, that are children that are sold by their parents, perhaps not because they knew that they were going to, you know, end up in a horrible circumstance, but that they were trying to send them off, you know, with somebody to have a better life. But there are any number is too many, but too many and a growing number of people that basically are trapped and had nothing to do with entering this environment and are now unable to escape or find it very, very difficult to escape.
My guest today is Dr. Suzette Grillot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma College of International Studies. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations speaking on transnational criminal organizations and how we can unwittingly contribute to it. How do we unwittingly contribute to some of these criminal organizations?
Well, one of the ways in which we can contribute, and many of us do contribute, of course, is, and this is, you know, confession time. I mean, how many of us haven't, you know, downloaded, pirated music or movies, or perhaps more commonly purchased a counterfeit item, something we knew was a knockoff on the streets of New York or Chicago or Rome, what have you. These are easy things to find. And we think, you know, cheap product sold perhaps by somebody who's, you
looks
know,
as from, good as the real
it,
one.
Looks as good as the real one, a lot cheaper. And, you know, maybe even we're trying to support the person who's selling this product on the street. What we don't always realize is that we're not necessarily supporting that person. We're supporting that person's network. And most often that person is an illegal immigrant and somebody that is paying off a debt and that is not really benefiting from that transaction. So counterfeit products is a big way that we contribute, whether it's, again, you know, handbags or perfume or medications on the internet. You have to be very careful about what you purchase on the internet because there are a lot of counterfeit products there. There are a lot of stolen products there. We can contribute to the world of money laundering by purchasing things on the internet. Now, it may seem very simple and easy, and so if you're going to eBay or Craigslist, really pay attention to who you're purchasing these items from, because a lot of times these items are stolen and then laundered through that system of buying and selling on the internet.
I'm assuming the websites look perfectly legitimate, like you're buying from a real store?
Absolutely. So the stores themselves can look very real. They're storefronts. Just like we would, if we used to refer to storefronts, physical storefronts. I mean, you have storefronts on the internet that look very real, and you could dig deeper, and even it looks like it's completely legitimate. But even on legitimate sites like eBay and Craigslist, these large auction sites where you just never know who that seller is. It's not that everything on these sites are illegal, obviously, or stolen, or supporting something. But you really have to do your homework. You have to really pay attention to who you're buying from, because this is a way, and again, going back to that notion of the digital world contributing to enhanced opportunity for illegal and illicit activities, this is one way where it really has happened. The internet and buying and selling on the internet has really contributed to that. And we don't even have to get into discussions about the deep web and all of the criminal activity that's going on at certain levels
on the dark web,
right? Uh-huh. That you really have to work hard to find. These things are very easy to find, right?
So when you see a sale that seems too good to be true on, say, eBay or one of these auction sites, perhaps they are.
That is absolutely
true. And you
true.
May get the product.
Yes.
I think that's most people think they're going to be defrauded in a transaction. They'll get the product, but the product was stolen to begin with.
The product was either stolen or it is a counterfeit. And let me just mention there are a couple of different kinds of counterfeit activities. We tend to refer to knockoffs. I was talking about knockoffs earlier, that it looks the same, and that's what a knockoff is. It's you take a designer product of some sort and you create something that looks very much like it, but it isn't like it. It doesn't have the same stamp. It doesn't have the same, kind of brand that's obvious on it, but it looks like it, a knockoff, right? Versus a real counterfeit, where they use the same materials and the same labor. And some refer to it as the third shift implants. And this is very true in China, for example. There are a lot of these products are produced in China.
In the same factory where the real ones.
In the same factory where the real ones are produced, and they're produced in that third shift, basically referring to the fact that they're not licensed products. And then those find their way into this counterfeit world where, again, they're the same product. They're using the same material. They may not be the same quality material or the same quality construction because of that different process of producing it, and perhaps the different labor that you use to produce it.
They may be taking rejects from the
right,
line, right?
Exactly. So that, and it diminishes the value of that brand and is contributing, again, to this environment that is not above board and not legal.
Now, when you have a situation like that in a state, say China or other countries in Southeast Asia where, the wages are low, you have these big transnational companies building factories there, are the states taking any real serious efforts to actually police that?
Well, let's go ahead and keep picking on China and that region. They're not the only counterfeiters in the world. They're not the only ones that struggle with these issues of protecting property rights. But it is certainly the main part of the world where we see some of this happening. And no, quite frankly, the governments are not necessarily doing everything they can to prevent property rights and intellectual property from being stolen and reproduced. And this means even in the drug industry and many other industries, whether it's we're talking about film and music or prescription medication or, Gucci handbags, there is a real disconnect in some ways in the sense that government officials often are looking the other way and are not able to control this type of activity.
And I assume a country really has no great desire to do this until they have their own intellectual property, which is being similarly hijacked by the next lowest wage country.
Sure. I mean, there's always that race to the bottom and the chase for that ultimate dollar.
I mean, I've heard that China is starting to get a little serious about that because they have their own intellectual property.
Well, that's true. And people are starting to knock off Chinese things. But, I mean, there's a long way to go between knocking off Chinese products and the Chinese activity when it comes to counterfeiting. I mean, everything from wine to truffles. Truffles are being counterfeited. in China and elsewhere to medication. And this, and I want to really emphasize again prescription medication, because we've seen a tremendous amount of evidence of prescription medication that comes from different parts of the world. But let's just stick with this Chinese example that is not produced safely, is not produced legally, and they use dangerous products. And in the case of a recent incident where a Chinese company produced cough syrup using an ingredient that was found commonly in antifreeze, but it found its way through many different ports and many different destinations before it ended up in Panama, where it sickened and killed 200 people before they even knew it hit them.
Wow.
It was a local clinic that purchased this very cheap cough syrup and distributed this cough syrup, because obviously it was a good deal for them, and they don't have much money, obviously, to produce these kinds of things or to run their healthcare system, so they saw it as a good deal. So, that's an extreme case of very dangerous prescription products. But the other side is you might just have prescription products that don't do anything, right? You buy online, a cheap version of a blood pressure drug or an asthma drug, or quite frankly, Viagra is often on the, counterfeited and sold regularly on the internet. And those just may not work. They may not be effective,
just
but
totally,
they may not hurt you.
Totally inert.
Exactly.
Ingredients.
So that's a wide range. And again, these are coming out of certain parts of the world. Latin America as well is counterfeiting a lot of these kinds of products. And that's really, it's a growing industry.
Hmm. One of the things, we haven't really talked a whole about the internet, but one of the big weapons in anti-terrorism has been provisions of the Patriot Act, which involve like anti-money laundering. And I'm wondering, are there people contributing to the traditional act of immigrants sending money home where money is being hijacked in a variety of ways?
Well, absolutely. Money is flowing around the world in large numbers and large volume every day. And so the fact that some of the, I think I'm not an alarmist, and I'm not suggesting that all of these transactions, are dangerous. I think you'll find people that will say, be careful everything you do because you could be supporting a terrorist. I don't think that we should go that far. But yes, there's too much money that's being transferred around the world that is supporting cases and causes and individuals and groups that we wouldn't want to support. And the underlying issue is that so much of what we do now is very invisible, right? Because we make these transfers, we may not even have any clue that we're contributing to something. We buy products that we have no clue who the original producer of that item was. Was it a child that was, attached to a rug loom? We don't know. So it's incumbent upon the consumer to be knowledgeable of what they're buying and to whom they're transferring money, and being willing to push their officials to establish the proper guidelines and procedures and programs that will control for these things. You have to have that activity from both ends, from in terms of our demand for products and our willingness as individuals to not contribute to the danger, but also to hold our government officials and our systemic institutional procedures, accountable and make sure that those are in the proper place too. So, that kind of gets into the kind of what do we do about all of this, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, is where, we ultimately have to go, is there's a lot that can be done. There's a lot that's being done. But we all have to be willing to play a role in preventing this sort of thing from happening.
Now, two other areas that you've focused a lot of time and work on has been two really intractable areas. One is port securities, which when you look at the volume of traffic coming into America's ports, it's just amazing to me that we haven't had more incidents, because you're looking at something like 144 million. There's a term for it. It's a 20 foot container, mm-hmm. basically. 144 million a year coming into the country. It's something like 50,000, 60,000 a day. And I can't imagine we're in any way equipped to really know what's in every one of those containers coming into the country.
No, we can't possibly.
There was one example in Detroit over the Windsor Bridge where they were inspecting every container, and it was like the lines went back days get across the bridge.
And that's exactly why we can't check every single container that comes into this country. But we do have to have the best procedures to try to, establish the checks and the balances so that we are properly catching the things that we need to catch. Unless we just want things to come to a screeching halt, and we don't, because we want our stuff on the shelves. We want to be able to buy our products, and we want our things to move in an efficient manner. But yes, we have to have the proper procedures in place. Now, the U.S. government has done really an incredible job, and this comes out after September 11th, 2001. A program called the Container Security Initiative that more or less pushed U.S. borders out overseas to other countries that are high-volume ports through which U.S.-bound products are transshipping or are being produced and coming to U.S. ports. And this was a brilliant idea that requires a global effort and a tremendous amount of cooperation. And so in the book, Protecting Our Ports, it was amazing to see the level of activity and U.S. Involvement in the shipping procedures and activities in China, in Hong Kong, in Pakistan, and all throughout Latin America, all throughout Europe. I mean, the U.S. fingerprint is now, and customs officials are now available and working at ports around the world.
So the customs is not done in the United States. It's done before they leave.
It's done before they ever even get to the United States, some of that customs work. And that's obviously a lot of data gathering and mining and looking at manifests, knowing shippers, knowing producers, knowing where things are going, following routes. There's a lot of intelligence work that goes into this, multiple points at which things are checked and rechecked. And that is a tremendously more efficient way than stopping every single container and having a look at what's going to come into our borders. Now, ports around the U.S. also have an exit process for those containers, whether they leave on rail or truck. They most often go through some sort of portal that will alarm, depending. And I've watched this happen in ports all over the United States, where an alarm would go off, and then there would be this process of matching the manifest to the kind of detection, radiation or other detection that's coming out of that container, and making sure that, let's say, if it's marble, which does produce a certain amount of radiation, that it's consistent. And so, there's a lot of science that goes into this as well. There's a lot of technology of various kinds all around, not only the United States, but we've exported a lot of the technology to ports around the world so that they are better able to control for these types of things. So, it's a worldwide network trying to protect the items that are coming into this port. But nonetheless, things get through. And it's fascinating, actually, to see the amount of counterfeits in particular that make their way through the system. We definitely are super biased toward explosives and weapons and particularly weapons of mass destruction. And, that's clearly what we need to do. We don't do as good a job in stopping some of these other items from coming through. But if you go and visit any of these ports, and I can tell you right now, if you've seen one port, you've seen one port. There's no such thing as a duplicate port. All ports are completely different. And that's also a challenge, right? In the sense that how do you establish common practices and procedures, policies, activities in ports that are all very, very different? Their geography is different. Their circumstances are different. So, it's a big challenge to do this in many, many different ways. But to go and see warehouses full of, counterfeit and other types of products that have been confiscated, knowing that it's a very small percentage, really, of what they're able to catch. But I'm confident that the United States government has done a great deal on this front. But I also know that they have a lot of road to haul on this issue as well.
All right. Well, Dr. Grillot, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Suzette Grillot is the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. She spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.